Welcome to Special Sauce, Serious Eats podcast about food and life. Every week on Special Sauce, we talk to some of the leading lights of American culture, food folks and non-food folks alike.
I like the moments.
And it's only when we try to extend them that we get into trouble.
Like a dinner party.
Right.
Right? Who needs that? How long can you sit and make conversation with people? How long? I think it's torture.
This week, we are very excited to welcome artist, writer, illustrator, and above all, thinker and provocateur, Myra Kalman. Myra is the author of many books, including Beloved Dog and The Pursuit of Happiness and The Principles of Uncertainty. She is the illustrator of Michael Pollan's Food Rules in hardcover, which I didn't even know because I only have the soft cover.
It's after the fact.
Yeah, exactly. And the best-selling edition of the writer's Bible, The Elements of Style, by William Strunk and E.B. White. Myra's work is shown at the Julie Saul Gallery in Manhattan and has been collected for various museum exhibits and shows all over the country. A lot of them I've seen, by the way. And she has co-written and illustrated the new book, Cake. Welcome to Special Sauce, the multi-talented, prolific, and apparently food-obsessed Myra Kalman.
Thank you very much. Good to be here.
I'm going to start with the first question I ask everybody on Special Sauce, which is, tell me about life at the Kalman family table growing up.
Well, there are different Kalman family tables. So if as a child, there was a lot of silence. There were different parts of the family, but my immediate family, there was a lot of silence. There was a lot of tension. And so maybe not the most glowing memories on earth. I had a larger family, the extended family in Israel, which was very boisterous and fantastic, with all the women, wonderful cooks, wonderful bakers, and a lot of celebration and a lot of getting together and just talking and talking and talking. So there were two very distinct features of my childhood.
Even in Israel, like in Tel Aviv.
Right. Well, what happened was that we left Tel Aviv when I was four. So New York was a different tone, and going back to visit the family was a much warmer, lovelier, livelier tone.
So tell me about the Tel Aviv extended family meals. Like, what were you eating?
We were eating a mix of Eastern European cooking, schnitzels and heavy meat dishes, even in a place like Israel where it was hot so much of the time. But of course, that culture was brought from Belarus, and those dishes were, you know, blintzes and all of those Jewish cooking. And then there was the Middle Eastern eggplant and salads and fish, the beautiful bounty of the Middle East. So they intersected in this really wonderful way.
And people were baking their own bread and everything?
Everything. But of course, you know, as in life in the city, there's a wonderful person down the block with the little bake shop. So, okay, we'll make things a little bit easier. I mean, the women worked like beasts, both in Belarus and in Israel, shopping and cooking and slaving away really from morning till night, but never complaining, which is also kind of amazing. Like,
and in New York, your mother, was she serious about cooking?
Well, I don't know if serious is the right word, but we had to eat and somebody had to make it. And it was my mother, of course. And we did go out to restaurants a lot. And that was another aspect of life, because in Israel, nobody was thought of going out to a restaurant. And here there was the experience of finding out what a basket of rolls was like at Patricia Murphy's, or going to Chock Full of Nuts, or going to fancy restaurants. And really, my ideal life, I live in a hotel and I go to restaurants every night. There's nothing at home at all. But my mother was a wonderful cook. She made eight things very well and stuck to them.
And so there was a rhythm to the meal plan at your house.
There was a rhythm. It happened. You know, as a child, you don't ask who's making it, where is it coming from. It just appears and there you are.
And what was the conversation like at that table?
Well, in New York, the conversation, as I said, was not so much. My parents were not a happy couple. And so that probably translated into a stiffer kind of situation. I always had a good sense of humor, so I was the funny jokester.
You could break the mood.
I could try to break the mood. I broke the mood for myself. I don't know what everybody else was thinking. I don't even want to go there. Let's leave. This is going to be a very dark show about sad memories.
So I have this picture in my mind of you, even as a child in New York, just madly sketching away and writing phrases in a notebook, even as a child, no matter what was going on around you. Is that what it was like, or am I just conjuring that?
You're a good conjurer. I was a very outgoing, happy-go-lucky child. And when I was about 7 or 8, I thought I was going to be a writer. So I didn't have journals or sketchbooks. I just would sit down and write stories. I read Pippi Longstocking, and I thought, that's it. I'm going to be a writer. This is my kind of job. It was only after, and my sister was the artist, so we kind of divided our turf. And then when I became disenchanted with my writing, I thought, well, what would be a great narrative way to tell a story and to do it in a funnier, happier way? And Saul Steinberg had a great influence on me at the time that I said, you can really do cartoon and art and words, and there's a place to do this.
Right. Now we should, for people who don't know, Saul Steinberg was amazing. Graphic artist, I guess you'd say, or artist in general, and he did the famous New Yorker cover where everything beyond the Hudson was. I had that poster framed, I think, in college.
Right, I think we all did. So
yeah.
The sense of humor and pathos in the work was really something that struck me. I said, you don't have to always be funny, and you can switch between being serious and being playful. And so that really became, and of course, you know, children's books have that combination also. And so I started to paint more seriously and became an illustrator because I love books and magazines. And I thought, this is a wonderful job to have. I'm not an artist. I'm an illustrator.
Well, you may think you're an illustrator. I kind of think you're an artist. And I think you're a really wonderful writer. You're almost writing haikus, you know, when you write. And it's interesting that you mentioned that combination of sort of optimism and pathos, you know, in Steinberg's work, because I also think about that a lot in your work. There are moments like there's that line that you wrote that I just read again, which is watching someone eat soup breaks your heart. And, you know, that's poetry, you know, and it's incredibly resonant. And there's pathos there, obviously, but there's also, you're hinting at the comfort that someone may be only getting temporarily from the soup.
All comfort is temporary. So we know that to be a fact. But when you understand that, then you can really allow yourself to look at those moments during the day, and they become very important, and they're very shining moments. So it's not just a big passing mush. It's really, what are the important moments? They can seem so insignificant, but they're really splendid and give you, and I think those are the happiest moments that people have, when you're alone and a fleeting something happens and you feel a sense of joy. So I'm looking for those.
You know, there's that famous, I was in the jazz business for a long time. Eric Dolphy was a beautiful clarinetist, flautist, and he once said something about, once you hear some music, it's over, and it can never be recovered. You know, that moment, you know, that moment of just intense beauty.
Yeah.
And that's really what you're talking about, right?
Yeah, it is.
It is, by definition, fleeting.
It is fleeting. And then you have to understand that all of it is fleeting, and embrace that.
Yeah. So you've said that food is a subject that you're crazy about.
Room service, breakfast, and bed. Let's start with the basics. And usually, you know, I've spent traveling a lot, and I order breakfast in bed because I want to see how they serve it and what the dishes are and what's the tray and what's the napkin. And I photograph it, and I do drawings, and I've done pieces for magazines. So it's professional on my part. It's professional research. But I adore all the trappings of table settings and what goes around it. I would like to work in a hotel. I worked as a maid in an Irish castle for a few weeks, and that was heaven. So I can see doing that. I'd like to get a job in a hotel serving somebody else breakfast.
And what is on your, if you were to construct your perfect room service breakfast, what would it be?
Well, the linen would be fantastically well starched, and
okay.
It would be beautiful. It would be white. It would be impeccable. And then there would be a beautiful pot of coffee in some kind of silver pitcher with the, you know, that keeps it hot. And then the food would be what? Croissants, lemon pound cake, maybe a few poached eggs.
Perfectly poached eggs. I like this. This is a very unusual, but...
Jam.
Okay.
That's a good... That's so far so good.
That's delicious.
Fruit.
Fruit. Making, all right.
I'm having them bring a bigger platter to my bed. Now they're rolling a card in and saying, where should we put this?
And how do you take your coffee?
With a splash of half and half.
A splash of half and half. No sugar.
No.
I watched this short promotional film you did about collaborating with Michael Pollan, illustrating the hardcover edition of Food Rules. And you said that you had to explain to Michael, and maybe it was you had to rationalize this, that cheese doodles played an important part in your family history.
You know, I was very worried that if he found out that I ate cheese doodles, like the deal is off. But it, what's interesting about this, I wasn't kidding. I thought, uh-oh, I better really tell him this whole cheese doodle thing.
And what happened? Because I had a similar experience with him, you know, where you, because you, yeah, you're like, yeah, Michael Pollan, he's like the chief justice of the food police.
Right. Hide the Snickers, you know, hide the Snickers bars. He's a very sweet man. He's forgiving and understanding. No, it wasn't a problem.
It wasn't a problem.
And I got to do a painting of a cheese doodle, so hurrah for that.
You've also described food as being a lot of things: celebratory, ritual, family, families fighting, memories.
Of course, I say, of course. What else is there? I mean, there. I don't mean what else is there besides food. But I think people think about food a tremendous amount of the time. We're always trying to figure out what's the next meal going to be.
It's funny. I had a radio show on WNYC a long time ago, and it was Nora Ephron and Calvin Trillin and Ruth Reichlin. And I said to Nora Ephron, so, like, what does food mean to you? And she said, besides love.
Right. Exactly.
You know, and it was like, and she was just like, that's so obvious, you know, like to her. And she loved food too, obviously.
She did, right. Right.
And I can imagine you two must have known each other at least a little bit. Hung out. It was just like, oh, yeah, dodo head, besides love. You know, I was like, let's start there. You posed a question in another one of your books, which was, do dogs eat when they're depressed? So it's because you love dogs. You probably don't even remember all the stuff I'm...
This is like a different person sitting here.
Oh, wait. No. It was really you. Because you love dogs. And you just posed this question and made me laugh. And then I started thinking about our beagle, who passed away a few years ago. And actually, I don't think he was ever depressed because he had no reason
to be
depressed.
Right, why would he be? He's a beagle.
He was a beagle. Yeah. He ate everything, and he was a genius beagle, so he could nudge the chair next to the counter so he could get things on top of the fridge because he had to get to the counter and then do his dolphin thing and go up and over and get it. And then this is what he would do that would make him – definitely the recipient of a MacArthur Genius Award, is that he'd take the bagel and he would go to precisely the center underneath our bed. So we couldn't get it.
Oh, I thought you were going to say that he would take the bagel and cut it in half and put cream cheese on it perfectly.
Now, that would have been awesome, but
wouldn't that be great to imagine? But no. Yeah.
But he went to our bed and then to a place we couldn't get to before he could eat the bagel.
Right. A little privacy, please.
He needed exactly. Yeah. It's just like I'm on the modified American plan, you know, at your house. So he was never depressed, you know. It's like I just don't know. Sometimes dogs look sad, but I think it's just because of their eyes and their faces rather than their real emotion. I mean, they're sad when you leave, obviously. They
say they are.
Right.
Who knows what they really are?
Now, you've also said, I know I'm like bringing up all these things. You're like, why is he bringing all this stuff up? But you said, I'd like to own a food cart and sell donuts and rubber bands. And I didn't know what donuts had to do with rubber bands.
Just different objects of affection. the sort of the basic elements of life, you know, that you need. So I had a little cart. I had a little stand where I sold rubber bands in Chinatown. And I have pop-up shops where I do sell
really?
The things. Yeah. I have pop-up shops at McNally Jackson, for instance.
Uh-huh. That was right near our old office. The Sirius Seats office was on Grand Street.
This is on Princeton. So I like the entrepreneurial moments of collecting the things that seem really small and unimportant. Again, it's really the same thing as collecting emotional moments or observing emotional moments that they're like, oh, this is really, you probably really need a rubber band and you probably really need a donut and I will sell it to you and I will have money.
Right.
Obviously not much money, but some right. money.
Really, I don't know what the margins would be on rubber bands.
I think they're steep, but we'll look into it.
We'll look into yeah. it. And you also once said that you wanted to, you've had fantasies. This makes sense now that you're telling me about pop-ups, that you want to have a food truck or a food cart.
Some kind of cart, yeah, some kind of traveling. And, you know, when the bookstalls on Fifth Avenue, we were working at Barnes & Noble at the time, my late husband and I, and one of the things that I wanted to do was push a cart of books through Central Park, and he said, that's a little bit laborious. Why don't we come up with something better? So he got in touch with the Strand and with another Biblio and Tannen at the time, and the three bookstalls on Fifth Avenue across from the, from the Pierre.
Right.
59th. And
right. From the Plaza. Excuse
from the Plaza. Yes, yeah. 59th and 5th.
Right.
So that sense of interacting in a very quick, you know, these short-lived experiences, interactions, conversations, I like them a lot. Yeah. I like them much better than having longer.
Yeah. You're a big fan of moments, aren't you?
I like the moments.
It's an interesting concept, you know, because in a way, you've said, and I agreed when I read what you wrote, that's all we have. You know, it's like it's a series of moments, you know, and it's only when we try to extend them unnaturally that we get into trouble.
Like a dinner party.
Right.
Right? Who needs that?
You mean because it should just be a moment of eating
it's
a cookie.
It's too long. How long can you sit and make conversation with people? How long? I think it's torture. So.
And it's totally unnatural. This is what I try to tell my wife because she loves to throw dinner parties. And I never really put my finger on it before, Myra, but I think you've hit on it. It's just like they seem to go on a long time.
Interminable. I also like to be in bed by 9, so that makes my dinner party life really... No, I like to be in bed by 8.
By 8?
I like to... I'm not sleeping at 8, but by 8 I'm thinking, what's the point?
Are you an early morning
creative person? I'm very early morning walker in Central Park and then getting to work. So the morning, I'm willing to live the morning hours, but the night hours make me very unhappy.
You have said, if you want to take me on a fantastic day, take me to a supermarket on a Saturday night.
You said it. Let's do it. The supermarket is a place of such endless interest in both in terms of product, design, typography, language. It's just endlessly fantastic. And there are always new products there. People are always trying to figure out how to package the next, I don't know what.
Ketchup.
You know, sardines.
Right.
Something. Anything. Everything. And just I really love the endeavor of people trying to figure out how to make these products, how to sell you these products. And there's from a place that doesn't have much choice to a place that has ridiculous choice.
You really love packages.
I do. I collect packages and boxes and things. And I think that they are an opportunity for photography and illustration. Again, the most wonderful phrases and sentences, the most ridiculous, meaningless things that people think will interest you in buying the product. So we're all trying to do that with whatever it is that we're doing. We're trying to figure out what's the best way to present this thing so that you might want it. And
yeah.
And also, I don't know. I like the lighting. I like the music. It's really, which is often terrible. Sometimes they sell bouncing, you know, they have other things they sell you, like bouncing balls, which I always buy, or shoes. Not
yeah,
really shoes.
Now,
flip-flops, maybe.
T-shirts, flip-flops. They're definitely flip-flops.
It's your whole life in one shop.
And has anyone ever taken you up on that?
We do that all the time.
Really?
Yeah.
You really just go and you hang.
Of course, yeah. I mean, we also go to the Met. I don't only hang out in supermarkets. But so the Metropolitan Museum happens to be another kind of supermarket, actually.
You're an artist with so many talents. You work in so many different media. What inspires you? How do you decide what project to work on? Is it whatever comes your way, or is it things that you initiate?
At this point, I'm initiating most of the projects. So if somebody contacts me and I like it and it's interesting, I'll respond. I mean, it's always been a mix of those things. In the beginning, I had to take on more work than I may have wanted to, just because you need to in the beginning. So the only driver, the only real driver is instinct. And what else do you have? What's interesting, what you think you love. People, I don't want to work with people I don't like. I don't want to work with people who have, ethical feelings different than mine.
Values.
Thank you, values. Senses of humor, kind. So it's a big decision to embark on a project. But at this point, the editors I work with, my agent, Charlotte Sheedy, they're all people who I respect tremendously, and I can talk about what is this thing that I'm thinking about? What's this next project?
So yeah, it's a wonderful place to get to, and a lot of people don't ever get there.
That's a shame.
Yeah.
Because it's a really incredible place to be.
Were there moments where you were like, I'm not going to get there, I'm sick of doing this work with people that I don't really want to be working with? I mean, everyone obviously goes through periods like that.
Right. In a daily kind of, is this working out? Am I really liking this? But in the bigger picture, I've never thought, I should have, I should have been a ballerina, but now I'm dancing in a ballet. So what can I tell you?
And I want to hear about this. You're doing a dance project. I don't know what to call it, a performance.
Performance piece.
Tell us about that.
So I was the duck in Isaac Mizrahi's production of Peter and the Wolf at the Guggenheim. And the choreographer was John Higginbotham, who used to be a dancer for Mark Morris. So we'd been friends for quite a while, and he said we should work on something together. And so we created a piece that's very impressionistic of the principles of uncertainty, which performed at BAM last fall, Jacob's Pillow. We just came back from Bulgaria.
Wow.
The big time.
Does it make you nervous? Getting on stage and dancing?
If you call it dancing, that would be a stretch. I'm moving some, and I'm speaking some, and I'm a presence on the stage. But now we're working on a new piece. He's actually requiring me to do actual extended movements. Thank you very much, movements. So I have to gulp. But I think that I'm nervous, but once I'm on the stage and if I can pray that I remember my lines. And for one section, I embroidered my lines onto my tunic, so there wouldn't be any issue. But it's an extraordinary adventure.
And especially for you, who you claim in your books, and you've drawn so many dancers, that obviously dancers have held a special fascination for you for a very long time.
I think that movement, everybody moves. And the way that the dance of people walking down the street is extraordinary, which is a heroic, how do we all manage to walk down the street?
Another moment in a book of yours where you talk about coming upon a chair that somebody's thrown out is a gift when you're walking in the city.
And there are a lot more chairs that people have thrown out and sofas that people have thrown out than you ever imagine. I love chairs, and I think they're also an endless source of interest. The design of them is just so. I have a lot of books about chairs, and I love the idea that there is this fantastic broken old chair that's on the street. It just speaks to me.
I love that. So, did you and your late husband ever work together?
Oh, we worked together all the time.
So, Company was both.
Well, there were people there who were real designers, and I was very much behind the scenes. But we collaborate. We met in summer flunk out class at NYU, and when we were just 19. So we were together for 30 years, and the conversation started that day we met and didn't end till he died. I mean, our collaboration was vital for both of us.
And that's a lot of moments in 30 years.
That was a lot of moments and kids and that kids. We made. Yeah.
Yeah, which is fantastic. And, you know, I work for a company called Fred Allen. I don't know if you remember, but Fred Seibert hired you at M & Company to do the MTV logo, right?
Wow. Was it the logo?
I can't remember if it was the logo. It was something
else. And did it work out? Or
yes. There's no dirty laundry
right, exactly.
to be aired here.
There could have been. But at any rate, that's good to hear. Right.
And I also have, I think through whatever work we did, I have one of the M & Company watches.
You do? Which one do you have?
The one with the... What's happening with the numbers?
The numbers are all in different places.
Yes.
Yeah, the askew. That's
so
my favorite.
Tell people.
My kids learned how to tell time on that clock.
So describe that watch for our listeners.
It's a classic. The designs from M & Company, one of the things that we wanted to do was to do whatever we wanted to do because that's how we felt about things. I studied literature and Tibor studied history. So there wasn't – we both plunged into design and illustration and that world with an optimistic naivete. Why can't we do whatever we want? So we decided to design watches, and one of them, so they were Swiss made, they were very pristine, very elegant, very
beautiful.
Minimal. And then, but we played with them, and the numbers on one particular watch were in different positions. So all the numbers were scrambled, they weren't consecutive. And you really understand that you don't need them to be the numbers, it's really the position. The one that's in the permanent collection at MoMA is the 10-1-4. We took away all the numbers except for the 10 and the 1 and the 4, which are in their proper positions. So it was a beautiful exercise. Because both of us came from other countries and we both learned English and we both fell madly in love with all of the vernacular of the American culture, it was easy for us to not take anything for granted.
What's amazing about your work is it's so thoughtful, but there's nothing condescending about it. There's nothing snobbish.
The approach was never to be cynical, never to approach it from a superior point of view or an arrogant point of view. That the whole endeavor is meant to communicate and not to isolate anybody. And my desire is to communicate with everybody, children, adults, dogs, cats not so much, but... That sense of we're all in this together. I have a sense of humor. I can use the absurd in a way that you might not, but it's not going to be antagonistic. It's going to be inclusive. It's going to be humanistic towards you. And that's how I've always felt.
Yeah.
I have an empathy for mankind.
Yeah.
One with humankind.
That's really the other strand is this sense of empathy. You really do put yourself in other people's shoes.
And I feel sorry for everybody, including myself. Well, you know, our family phrase is poor every, at the end of every day, we just go, poor everybody. Good night. So, it's a nice way
that.
To end the day, isn't it?
Poor everybody.
Buddy.
Good
yeah.
night.
Yeah.
Okay. So now it's time for the special sauce, all you can answer buffet. And you don't have to worry. We don't, you know, there's no time and imagine we're just an M & Company watch, you know. So it's just a series of moments. It's just a series of moments.
I love this. Is this like a lightning round?
Yeah, it's a little bit like a lightning round.
This is exciting.
So who's at your last supper? No family allowed. Dead, living, doesn't matter.
Marcel Proust.
Okay, Marcel Proust. And so you'd obviously...
Oh, more people?
Yeah.
Four
people altogether.
Ooh, okay. Gertrude Stein.
Okay.
Marcel Proust. Kafka, and am I the fourth? And
no,
me. And another person?
Yeah, you get another person, really... but this is quite a table.
Yeah.
It's going to be intense.
I know.
It is
I
not
probably will
gonna...
leave. I will go into the kitchen and not talk to them for the rest of the evening. I'll just serve them.
Exactly.
You know, Kafka wanted to be a waiter.
Really?
Yes.
So, all right. So, good. So, you have one more person.
You know why he wanted to be a waiter?
Why?
Because he wanted to overhear the fleeting conversations of people, but be invisible. I think that's genius.
Yes, and
that's
it gets back to moments.
Yeah, that's what I
so
want to do.
So there's one more person that can be at the table.
One more person. course.
Gertrude Stein, Kafka. I love this. Proust.
Marcel Proust. My grandmother.
No family allowed.
Oh, no family allowed.
Yeah, it could be
a musician. Okay, Bach.
Bach.
Okay.
Got it. All right, so what are you eating?
Oh, God, what are we eating? Pasta.
Okay, I like that. Simple. Not too heavily sauced, I presume.
I don't know. I'm now worried about which kind of pasta to serve. Like, this is what am I going to do?
And what would be for dessert?
Pavlova with berries.
Pavlova, yes. And I've seen you draw pavlova. I like pavlovas. We should explain their meringues, essentially, right? And people usually put fruit in them because they're puff meringues.
Yes. So you put cream in it or lemon. Creme fraiche or some kind of wonderful cream thing, and then laden it, as we like to say, laden it with berries and some sauce.
So pasta and pavlova.
Does that sound like a good dinner? I don't know.
It might need one more thing.
Okay, maybe forget the pasta and have a veal roast.
I like that.
Okay, a veal roast with potatoes and greens, and then the pavlova.
Got it. I like that.
Okay.
So, what are you listening to?
Well, I guess we'd listen to one of my guests' music.
But that's too easy.
We're listening to Glenn Gould playing Bach.
Okay. Do you have guilty pleasures when it comes to food?
Besides Snickers and cheese doodles?
Yeah, cheese doodles is obviously one.
It's not a guilty pleasure. It's just like, bring it on. chocolate chip mint ice cream. I think I could live on that.
Like, just have a pint.
Are you talking?
Yeah, that.
Yeah.
That.
I mean, I wouldn't sit down and have a pint, but I could. Maybe when I was pregnant, I did. Yes, I did. But
all right, I like this chocolate chip. Is there any others that immediately come to mind? I like Cheetos. You wouldn't have them together.
No. They're separate pleasures. I do love Snickers.
All right, that's good. So three books that have profoundly influenced your life and work.
Speak Memory. By Vladimir Nabokov, Marcel Proust, In Search of Lost Time. Well, we'll say Astrid Lindgren's Pippi Longstocking, just to round it out as the first book that I read that I went, I'm going to do this job.
It's interesting about Proust and the Nabokov book because they are about moments. You're really drawn to artists and writers and musicians that sort of live in the moment.
Well, what's funny about Proust is that, boy, he doesn't.
Yeah, exactly. Right.
But the
it's
looking back
extended
is that,
moment.
Right, exactly. The scrutiny of those, you know, for 20 pages of a moment is something extraordinary.
Yeah, for sure. So it's just been declared Myra Kalman Day all over the world. What's happening on that day?
A lot of naps are being taken.
Okay.
It's a napping day. It's National Napping Day.
That's
what's
good.
Happening?
Yeah. Well,
everybody's walking everywhere.
Okay.
Once you're well rested and you know you're going to have a nap later, everybody's walking everywhere.
Are they dancing?
If they want to. They don't have to be
dancing.
They don't
have to be dancing.
No?
They
walking.
Just walking.
Everybody's celebratorily walking.
Well, Myra, thanks so much for allowing me to pepper you with questions. I am kind of a fanboy, as I've told you, but I feel like we're just getting started here. We haven't even talked about your new book, Cake. So you're going to stick around to do that with your collaborator, Barbara Scott Goodman. But this is a wrap for this episode of Special Sauce. So long, Serious Eaters, and thank you, Myra, and we'll see you next time.
Thank you very much. It was fun.